Powered from the Perdomo Cigar Studios Red Stage in Indian Trail, North Carolina, and broadcasting from down under outside Brisbane, Australia, and broadcasting from Greensboro, North Carolina, it's episode 13 of Primetime Jukebox. Tonight, we have our first listener-voted album archaeology as we discuss the iconic record Led Zeppelin II. And Primetime Jukebox is sponsored by Perdomo Cigars, awarded Nicaraguan Cigar of the Year in 2014 by Cigar Journal. The Perdomo 20th Anniversary brand has consistently earned the highest scores in the industry and is a top seller in humidors around the world. Perdomo 20th Anniversary blend requires tobaccos that have been carefully hand-selected and are well-aged for a minimum of 8 years. The Perdomo 20th Anniversary is offered in three distinct wrappers: a smooth, creamy Ecuadorian Connecticut, a rich, earthy Cuban seed Nicaraguan sun-grown, and a dark, oily Cuban seed Nicaraguan Maduro. Combining these beautifully bourbon barrel-aged wrappers with thick, high-priming binder and filler tobaccos gives each blend a balanced complexity with layers of rich flavors and smooth, elegant aromas. Perdomo Cigars is a family-owned and operated company headquartered in Miami, Florida, with manufacturing and agricultural facilities in Esteli, Nicaragua. Perdomo's highly acclaimed cigar brands include the Perdomo Estate Selección Vintage, the Perdomo Double H 12-Year Vintage, Perdomo 20th Anniversary, Perdomo 10th Anniversary Champagne, Perdomo Habano Bourbon Barrel Age, Perdomo Lot 23, and many more. For great tasting notes and pairing information, check out the new Perdomo website at www.perdomocigars.com. And by Drew Estate, check out and download the Drew Diplomat app for your mobile device. Keep up with everything going on Drew Estate. Experience the subculture that is the rebirth of cigars, available on iTunes or Google Play. For more information, check out www.drewdiplomat.com. And as always, all the live streaming for the primetime shows are sponsored exclusively by Drew Estate. Well, welcome everybody. This is Primetime Jukebox episode 13. Will Cooper, I am in the Perdomo Cigar Studios on the Red Stage, and I'm joined tonight by my two esteemed co-hosts. First of all, down under from Brisbane, Australia, Mr. Dave Burke.
Hello, Will and Seth. Good to be here. Excited to talk Zeppelin II. I love talking Zeppelin, which people find out we'll be talking a lot more Zeppelin in the future as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Just sitting here with my HVC broadleaf and a Bang Star Blast in honor of Mike at Cigar Hustler, because had to try it when I saw it, and I told Seth it tastes like a cross between watermelon and cocaine. That's sort of what the Bangs taste like to me.
American dream, right there, man.
And, of course, my good friend from up in Greensboro, North Carolina, Mr. Seth Guy. Seth, how's it going tonight?
It's going great, man. Thanks for being back. Excited to talk about this subject and this album. Smoking this Davidoff Millennium Blend. Loving it.
There you go. And I have the Rocky Patel Tabacusa, which, you know, I think this has been one of the better Rocky Patel cigars to come out in the last couple of years. I've really enjoyed this blend a lot. I want to go back to Dave for a second, okay? Since we're talking about what we're smoking, Dave. So this is a pretty cool cigar that you're smoking right now, because it is the broadleaf coming out of Aganorsa right now. So this is your first time smoking it.
It is, yes.
Okay, so I think we're both kind of curious on your thoughts with that cigar as the show goes on. I'm gonna predict you like it a lot.
Well, I like it thus far. I mean, I got a bit of pepper and stuff in the beginning, but it's really smooth. And, like, if you look at the burn and everything, like, the construction's really good.
This kind of was
a solid blend.
It's a solid, but it was a throwback to the old Tatawahi broadleafs in a lot of ways to me.
Yeah, it was. I think it was.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's exactly, you know.
And it wasn't meant, you know, really quick, it wasn't meant to be like, you know, because for a lot of people, Tatawahi and my father's stuff was used with Aganorsa tobacco. This was not meant to be. I don't think this was meant as in, like, this is what they should smoke like. It's more of like a, you know, this is us with broadleaf, and it's fantastic.
That's how I took it as well. I mean, it had some of those tendencies to be like the throwback, but I don't want to say this was, hey, this was a carbon copy. I don't think that was the case at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, Dave, as the show goes on, feel free to like give us you know, some updates on this cigar there.
Well, like I said, right now it's smoking. What I like about it is it's quite smooth, but it's still rich. Like it's not heavy, I guess, is how to put it. It's like just really, really good, really balanced, and it's not too heavy on you, but it's still really good flavor on it.
I agree. Now, is yours a first selection on the secondary bin? Okay, so in my opinion, the first selection is actually smoked better than the ones that didn't say first selection. I'm not knocking the ones that didn't say it, but that first batch, which that's from the first batch you're getting.
All right.
I was really impressed with those.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of, you know, but yeah, keep us posted on that. Now, Dave, you have a package. My package I sent to you at the beginning of the month is in Australia.
It is.
So out of our postal system's hands right now. Can't be blaming the U.S. Postal Service. It is in Sydney. I'm hoping it looks like we'll have it for the next show.
Yeah. I think this goes out to all the listeners that are just dying to send me cigars in the mail and all you cigar industry people. It looks like the mail is caught up because I got this from Mike at Cigar Hustler, which is why I'm drinking the Bang as well. Which I have to say, I've had three sips of the Bang. By the time I finish this thing, I'm going to be twitching like a lab rat on this show. But
you got to lift some weights afterwards, man. That's the point, man.
Right.
But this shipment took about 10 weeks to get here. And it took so long that Mike and I thought it was lost in the mail. But he sent a recent package that I think took about 4 or 5 weeks, which is about normal. So I think the mail is about normal again.
Yeah, this one, little slightly longer maybe sent from me. But again, it wasn't like we didn't know where that package was that I sent back in March for all of April and into May. So
So
it did make it across the sea.
The Postal Service was just aging your cigars.
That's right.
They just are like, we're going to age these for you.
So, you know, to Skip and Hector and John Huber, everybody that watches the show that's like, you know, waiting to know when to send me all the samples, just pack a lot of Boveda packs in there and it'll be right.
Put some cedar in there as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just age it. Yeah. We're aging this.
Yeah, no, it's
that's
all
what good. You pay for. That's what when we mail it to you, we are paying to age your cigar.
We are.
That's right.
You're getting
welcome. You're welcome.
There's a special type of aging when that thing's on the rowboat over the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
The tax is actually for the aged tobacco. Like that's why it's taxed. Yeah.
Listen, it's like Jefferson Bourbon, you know, where like they put the casks in the boat and they sail it across the ocean. That's what we're doing with cigars. It's a premium you pay.
That's right.
Before we get to the Zeppelin stuff, let's just kind of hit some of the news items that hit this particular week in the music world. So, Dave, you want to take that? You want me to take that one?
Oh, no, I can do that. Okay. I just, since we're cigars and music, there's just been a little bit of music news. So there's a couple bands like changing names, and usually this is a lot of sort of country bands or like southern bass bands for the most part. So Dixie Chicks are taking the Dixie out of their name for their new record. So this will be called the Chicks on their new record, which a lot of that branding has sort of changed already since it's all digital. And those listening to the show know that I'm really excited about the new record. I've played a couple tracks off it. So they announced a change in their name, and with it, they released another song called March March, which is very, very good. It's a great song. And earlier, Lady Antebellum, if you're a Lady Antebellum fan, they changed their name just to Lady A instead of Antebellum. So a lot of the bands that are sort of have sort of the Southern iconography in their names are sort of changing that. And it's sort of been a topic around in the music world. And since we're both a cigar music show, I just thought I would bring it up because people might be reading about it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, and this is my take on this. You know, I'm not going to get very political. A band has a right to change their name. If they're not comfortable with it, that's their right and their privilege to do it. Yeah. And it's your right as a consumer if you buy into it or not. I see people just like they lose their marbles over this. Like, how is this happening? Like, what next? You know, like, just relax. They can change their name. If they're not comfortable, let them change their name. And as a consumer, if you don't like it, don't buy their record. It's simple. Don't listen to their music. Yeah.
And it's the crazy thing about it is like, how if you love the music so much,
right,
that they make a stance like, oh, I'm not going to listen to the music I love anymore. Like, you know, there's been plenty of artists in every band that have made comments that I'm sure I'm not a fan of.
Sure.
But I still listen to the music. I mean,
there's a point where you have to decide where that line is, that if you're not going to listen to the music or not. That there's a point, I think you just have to decide that. I've not agreed with everything. Like Springsteen and U2 have been very political. I haven't agreed with all this stuff. I haven't listened to one less bit of their music. I'm enjoying it. And if they let them have an expression of opinion, like a Green Day can have an expression of opinion. I might not agree with it, but let them express their opinion at least. We don't want to censor them either.
I mean, listen, I enjoy listening to Rage Against the Machine, but I don't believe in anarchy and destroying everything.
Right.
So.
Well, and the thing with the Dixie Chicks, or formerly known as the Dixie Chicks, now the Chicks, they did delay the release of their record till July. And it was originally going to come out in April. And they made this announcement recently. So I wonder if they're kicking this idea around and delayed the record so that they could rebrand everything and everything. And so they're just sort of, if it was sort of on their mind, and that's why they delayed the record. I mean, they haven't said that, but it would make sense because they would have to like rebrand everything. But
when you're preparing for a Dixie Chicks albums and then, wait, there's not a Dixie Chicks album. Where is it? Oh, it's the Chicks. And
Yeah.
So I wonder if they were sort of thinking of it and they delayed the record until they figured out what they were going to do and then like released all that now. But yeah, so that's just a bit of music news that's out and about.
Yep. Like I said, it's definitely out there for sure. I'm glad we didn't have to report on a death this week. That was actually pretty.
Yes, that's true.
That is positive.
Yeah, that was positive. It's never, I mean, you're always like reflecting on the positives, like when someone passes away, but it's still no fun to do that. So I'm kind of glad we didn't have to hit that this week. But this week, Battle of the Bands came to an end. I got to say, the pregame show got some really good feedback. I've seen the messages on that show. So thanks to you guys, by the way. That was a fun show, but we got really good feedback. I'll say this. Everyone knows Led Zeppelin was the winner. And Chad was the winner of our gift card, so he already has his gift card. Congratulations to Chad.
Way to go, Chad.
Yeah, he has a longer Twitter handle, which I can't remember, but he was in. But no, Chad, I think, was voting in every round, too, so he got in there a lot, and it paid off.
Was he a Beatles fan? I hope he was a Beatles fan. His gift card would make up for the fact that the Beatles got stomped by Zeppelin.
Right. Yeah. But Floyd got stomped, too.
Floyd got demolished.
So the first three hours was tight. I thought this was going to, wow, this could be tight. After the 3 hour mark, the remaining 45 hours was all Led Zeppelin.
All I can say is from monitoring the vote, Seth was acutely aware of the lead Led Zeppelin was having.
Oh, yeah.
He sent me a message. I said, Seth, it's over.
Oh, man. I was looking at that. I knew it was going to happen.
And it kind of stuck around that sort of 60-40, 70-30 sort of, what was it, like 63-30 something?
Yeah, 69.
Yeah, they won by like, what, like?
I'll pull it up. What?
Yeah.
But yeah.
It was like 64 to 30 something. Yeah, whatever
it was. Yeah, it was, like I said, and like you said, it hung around. It got to about, it's 63.3 to 36.7. But at some point, it was up to 70. But it's hard to hold a 70% lead as you get more votes.
Yeah,
so we had 30 votes in the final, which is pretty really good, you know, considering. So, and there are a lot more retweets than the votes indicated, I can tell you that. So a lot of people were just like retweeting, and I don't think voting either, just because they wanted to get the gift card.
They knew.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think what happened too was, you know, the Pink Floyd fans, the true fans saw it in the beginning, and they saw, and they're like, oh, Pink Floyd's so much of a better band. Then they lost attention. Then they started listening to Pink Floyd. And then they remembered why they were listening to Pink Floyd, and they're like, oh, crap, I have to vote. And that's what the surge in the end
was. Yeah.
They had all gotten distracted by listening to it. But it still goes to show there's Led Zeppelin's superior.
Wow. I mean, and it was, and by the way, this show was selected, we're going to do tonight on the album Archaeology, by the fans. Dave put a vote out there. This one, and that was before we even started the tournament. So this was kind of coincidental that the tournament ended and we had this show scheduled. It worked out like that. We actually added the extra show for the month for the last week. So big win, Led Zeppelin, I think, dominated. The challenge Led Zeppelin had was against the Cheap Trick contingent that came out early.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you, man.
Yeah. So let me ask some questions here. I actually just named a few bands here, artists, right, that I think, like, if Led Zeppelin was up against them, my question to you guys is, would Led Zeppelin have knocked out these bands, yes or no? I'll just name four here. The first one is U2.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Dane, that's tough.
That's a tough one.
I don't think they're knocking out Led Zeppelin. I don't think that's happening.
I think it's a shot.
U2 could – I don't know, Dave.
No.
It depends on the generation. Let's put it this way. Well,
if once U2 gets close, they put on the pop record, and then all the, you know, they put on Zooropa, and then all the votes.
Whoa! Don't go out.
Yeah, you heard me.
Oh,
that's one of those things. I think Bono makes and breaks that vote. People are like, yes, yeah, I'm going to vote for U2 because of Bono, and then people are like, wait a minute, I can't vote for U2.
Got the edge. The edge is in there.
I think too, with U2, you have sort of like your pre kind of Zooropa, and then your, so I think there's like fans of like Boy and Under Blood Red Sky and Unforgettable Fire that, I mean, it's this fractured fan base, whereas Zeppelin, it's like,
it's a consistent one,
very unified, I think. But
yeah,
I Zeppelin more.
I would agree.
I think they still, I would say there's more unity amongst the Led Zeppelin groups. I don't think any, you know, I think Led Zeppelin fans would say that, you know, Presence was nowhere near Led Zeppelin 2, but it's still a great album. But there's still plenty of people who'll say, man, Zooropa is whack. And then there'll be people like me who say, listen, Zooropa is actually one of the greatest, most underrated albums. And let me tell you why. So, Lemon, man.
Yeah, I like that album too.
What's the other group you had, Coop?
All right, next one. I have four. Next one's Elvis Presley.
Maybe.
Generations, maybe.
I'm going to say no. This is Elvis we're talking about, but I'm saying no. Mm. I don't think Elvis has carried over to the way that Led Zeppelin's carried. Like, in 60 years, Elvis hasn't done what Led Zeppelin's done.
No.
No.
Okay. So I think we're in agreement on that. Now, this one, I just kind of pulled this one out for, to see. If the Rolling Stones had made it instead of Pink Floyd, would the Rolling Stones have fared better in the matchup with Led Zeppelin?
Yes.
They might have fared better, but I don't think they would have won, though.
That's kind of how I'm feeling, too.
The problem with the Rolling Stones is that there's been so much transformation as a band, and there's a lot of people who appreciate different parts of the group. Like, you know, you have the Brian Jones in the beginning, then you have some people who really like when Mick Taylor was there. You like Ronnie Wood.
Right.
I think Ronnie Wood's a clown. He's actually really good.
But. No, he's good. He's a clown, but he's good. So is Rich, but he's good, yeah.
But he does a lot of the producing, I believe. I think, like, don't they record a lot of, like, one of his houses in Ireland or something like that?
Yeah, they do that, and he contributes to the songwriting as well. So, yeah. I think he was a very positive addition, yes.
Yeah, but there's a lot of Rolling Stones is another one of those bands that's changed every decade.
I think, too, what would be interesting is, like, then you're looking at, like, a comparable battle. So they were, like, contemporaries, more sort of bluesy rock. I mean, Zeppelin's a bit heavier, but yeah, it's more comparable where, like, you might get, like, a fan of both, you know, kind of voting. So it's, I guess, more so than Floyd in Zeppelin, which are a bit more difference there. It would be more interesting that way, I think.
But, you know, Zeppelin's a group that over 50% of the band is well known. And what I'd say for Led Zeppelin is 75% of that band is really well known and appreciated as being as fantastic. And that's nothing against John Paul Jones, because I think John Paul Jones is underappreciated.
Oh, yeah.
And the most behind the scenes greatest artist of all times. Mm-hmm. But there's not many other bands where over 50% of the band's really well known. I mean, when you think of Rolling Stones, you know, Mick Jagger, everyone knows that, or Keith Richards, and most people know Keith Richards because of his drug issues, but no one ever really recognizes the rest of the band. Like, how many people can name the bassist of Rolling Stones?
You know, it was Bill Wyman, but yeah, you're right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you're right. And I think if you had a look at if John Paul Jones was walking down the street with Charlie Watts, believe it or not, nothing against Charlie Watts, right? I mean, nothing against John Paul Jones, but Charlie Watts would probably be more recognized, even though John Paul Jones is beyond a superior musician.
Yeah, Charlie Watts would be more recognized than John Paul Jones.
Yeah.
It's like if you put Ringo Starr walking down the street. If you put Ringo Starr, Charlie Watts, John Paul Jones, who's going to be the most recognized of those three?
The only thing I'll say, I don't think a lot of people would recognize Bonham today because they don't remember. You know, like, all they have is the pictures of him, really. So, you know, like, everyone's had impressions of Robert Plant and Jimmy Page for 40 years, right, since Bonham died. But
Bonham got big in the end. He got heavy.
He got heavy, yeah. He
did. From the booze really got to him.
Yeah, no, it's true.
But you're right, though, Coop. I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. You know, we had this argument with some of the golf nerds, Seth. You know, when we were talking about Federer and some of these golfers, like, Federer is just going to be recognized. People are not going to recognize some of these golfers today. Brooks Koepka, who's dominated golf the last year, no one knows who he is.
Oh, yeah.
No one recognizes him, but Federer, they're going to recognize.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, like Laver with tennis, Rod Laver. Everybody knows who Rod Laver is. At least a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And he hasn't played tennis in how many years?
Yeah.
That's the same. Federer's going to have that same impact. Nadal will too. Yeah. I couldn't identify. I could only identify Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods probably.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I'm in agreement with you on that. All right, the last name I had on this was Michael Jackson.
Ooh.
No, maybe.
Depends who comes out the vote.
10 years ago.
I think it depends who the fan base would be. Jackson had a very big fan base.
He did. Man, Jackson was huge.
If you had said this to me in 2010, like right after he died, I would have said Jackson would beat him.
Yeah.
There was so many people like paying homage to him. Now that time has passed, you know, I don't know. I think Zeppelin still had a stronger has maintained that stronger presence right now because they're still around.
I think he has a bit of off the stage issues too that would keep him.
Well, that has never gone away, unfortunately.
What happens in Disneyland stays in Disneyland.
Yeah. That's so. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, like 10 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So last question before we kind of move on is there a band anyone could think of that would knock out Zeppelin?
I was thinking that.
No, man. I don't think so.
It's a fair – I mean, they won and dominated this tournament.
Yeah, they did.
It's one of these things. I mean, it kind of just goes to show – what they were as a group.
Yeah.
And it's okay that no one could compete with them. You know what I mean? Like, someone's got to be there. You know what I mean? Someone has to be that person or group to be, you know, the question is, will there ever be a group like that in our lifetime or in the future? You know what I mean? It's hard to see.
It's very hard to see.
I mean, especially so far removed. Like, I think if you were to do this same poll, maybe when Pearl Jam or Nirvana was at their height, they would have, but not now, I don't think.
Yeah. Look at Pearl Jam was huge.
Yeah.
But it's never reached, you know, Eddie Vedder is never going to be, you know, Robert Plant.
No. So I think if you're looking at bands, like, I don't think so. I mean, we had them up against some big names as well, and they just mowed right through them.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, they beat the Beatles, you know, so that says a lot. They beat the Beatles easy, and, you know, the Beatles, I mean, I always kind of was groomed that they were the greatest band of the last century, you know, and they came in there, and they beat them.
I mean, there were icons like Bob Marley and Aretha Franklin in that that bracket that didn't come out. Now, whether I can't remember if they went up against them directly, but like, and those are icons.
Oh yeah,
and they still didn't make it through. So I don't think so.
You even look at Pink Floyd, how they kind of were a juggernaut on my side of the bracket until they got up against Zeppelin. They looked ordinary in that matchup against Led Zeppelin. Nothing, and it's nothing against that is how big Led Zeppelin is. And you know, we were talking about this on the last show. The one thing that's hurt them, if you look at their like commercial ratings, is that they didn't release singles for the most part. And that's a big part when you start calculating the RIAA numbers and stuff like that, what's sold. They get hurt on that part because they were a true album-oriented band. And Pink Floyd, I think their numbers are higher. Well, they're higher around longer, but they're higher also because they had all those singles out.
Yeah.
They did have a lot of singles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I think that's a big difference. You may not see Led Zeppelin on it. That doesn't mean the impact and the way they've touched people out there.
Which kind of goes to show the greatness of the group that they committed to the album and they made people commit to the album. And they made them commit to at a time where it wasn't digital media and you could just download a song on your iPhone. You had to buy, you were committing to the album. So you had to hear it. You had to live it.
You nailed it. When we get into the tracks and this album archaeology, that is going to be a very key point of mine, that this is one you want to make the commitment to the album on.
Yes.
Because it's an album, and I think it's a great piece of work. Now, they've touched people in a lot of different ways. And on every show, we've had a connection with Dave and Dolly Parton.
That's right.
And Dave, Dolly actually loves Zeppelin.
That's right. Dolly's amazing, A. And B, she loved Led Zeppelin. Huge Zepp fan. Did a cover of Stairway to Heaven, which people are like, well, people cover songs all the time. She actually went to Plant and Page for permission to cover the song. And there's an article in Entertainment Weekly about that, where Plant, or I think their Plant is the one they're interviewing. And they not only gave her permission to do it, but said she could even add in her own lyrics if she wants.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And they loved it. They're like, what? Plant's like, well, it's not really my kind of thing, but you know, it's pretty good.
I actually put a link, and I have the video of her performing that, and it's amazing. It may be the best cover I've heard of it. I know people talk about the Heart cover. Far Corporation did one, but this one's right up there with, I think, the best covers I've seen. She's got some of the fiddles in there. She made that song work.
Bluegrass rendition.
Yeah, it really worked.
It's on a bluegrass record.
You have to, man. If you're going to cover Stairway, you really have to. That's a bold move.
It's a bold move.
But you know,
high school students are stupid enough just to say, yeah, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
But for Dolly, that's bold. Love it.
You know, like I said, it was a great cover of this. I'm going to say I was listening to it quite a bit over the last week. Just I enjoyed it that much. So, you know, I've seen people, like I said, everyone talks about the Heart one at the, and that was, I'm not taking anything away from what Heart did, and that they did a tremendous job, but this Dolly one's right up there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, fit it in there. Boom.
Yeah.
Dolly out the gate.
Yeah. So
Dolly would have voted for Zeppelin.
Dolly would have faced Zeppelin if she beat Aretha.
She still would have voted for him.
I mean, I don't know what Dave would have done on that one.
That's like me and the Allman Brothers, man. If you put Allman Brothers next to Zeppelin, come on.
I reckon they might win.
They may get Seth's vote.
That's a good point.
Who's this?
They got a very sort of... The Allman Brothers have a very loyal fan base. I reckon they could give him a run.
I think you know, I think if you put some albums, I think Allman Brothers could do. I mean, listen, we could talk about Allman Brothers. I think it's probably one of the first great American bands, but we can talk about that another day.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. I think the Allman Brothers, Led Zeppelin in the studio, what they did, I would give them the advantage.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah, there's no question. Now the Allman Brothers built their reputation from touring, and.
They did.
Yeah, so they were one of the ultimate tour bands. So that's, I think, where they bring. They may have a slight edge over Zeppelin on that. Not that Zeppelin hasn't had an epic live performance, but the Almonds were doing it for almost 50 years.
I just don't think Led Zeppelin was one of those bands, you know, from what I've read and what I've also heard was that, you know, they're going to produce something in the studio. It's going to be fantastic. But when you go to see them in concert, there's going to be a different version of it. And that's just because they were constantly seeking creativity and keeping things fresh and new, and they were challenging one another. I just think they had so much talent that they had to do something with it.
I agree. So let's get into the album Archaeology. And Dave, you've done an incredible amount of research into this album in particular, Led Zeppelin 2, voted on again by the fans. So I'm going to turn this one over to you, Dave, because there was some great info you uncovered on this as you were digging.
I'll just give a quick synopsis, or else we'll be here like all day just doing the record.
Okay.
A quick aside, this cigar is really, really good.
The
pepper sort of is kind of gone, and I got some sweetness, and it's just rich, and it's really good.
That broadleaf, yeah, they just that broadleaf with the Aganorsa tobacco. It's like if it's like a glove. That's all I'll just say.
Oh, it's really good.
Yep.
So this is how's everybody else's cigars? We do a quick cigar update before we delve into like sex and drugs.
Oh man, solid.
The Tabacusa is the it's like a quintessential Rocky Patel profile. It's caramely, it's cocoa-y, a little nutty, you know. It's like that's a very bad Rocky I did. But that's what this is. This is quintessential Rocky Patel.
I didn't know you were trying to do a Rocky, man.
That's how bad it was.
That's how bad it was. I think when I said nutty, I almost tried to say it like Rocky. And it was
you
it,
did. I was going to say, you said it weird, so.
Tabacusa is named after the Nicaraguan factory, which I've been to. And, you know, everyone they can bash Rocky all they want. That is the definition of a boutique factory. That the way they operate, it's very it's a small factory. They have agile the way they work there. It's, you know, it's a nice little factory, and this is a very good cigar coming out of there with it. I think this is, because if I had to say the last 4 or 5 years, this has been one of the better Rockies to come out.
It's a good stick, man.
It is, it really is,
and it's pretty price affordable if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it's I think it's around that a little under the $10 mark for the Robusto here.
I'm smoking this Davidoff on an interesting day for Davidoff after
rumors.
Ooh. Do we want to do rumors before we get into this, or are we rumor free, teaser free? Is that,
well, I don't think the rumor is true, so I don't think it would be fair.
Yeah, the rumor isn't.
All right.
Yeah, that's why I don't. So we'll tell you what the rumor was off the air, and folks who are listening, just they can go to KMA Talk Radio's.
It appeared I stirred up the president of the company as well, the operation.
Yeah. We didn't do it. This wasn't us. We just were given information that was incorrect. So,
love it.
Yeah. So I guess so go ahead, Dave.
Speaking of information.
Yep.
So now I think we'll get into this. I think Seth sort of like alluded to it, but the album was released in '69. They actually recorded the album and toured at the same time, which is just insane. So when you look at this record, so Jimmy Page produced it. He produced all of Zeppelin's records, except they had different engineers. So Page's production style was he'd work really closely with engineers that would like tweak songs and that sort of thing. They would record all over the place. So some of it might be in Seattle, some of it might be in England, some of it might be in like Chicago or something. Yeah. So they would be touring and going into the studio with these songs. So if you look into the history of the album, you're going to find instead of like, I think we think of Zeppelin sometimes as they go to like, you know, Headley Grange and they sit down there and they just do a lot of drugs and record an album. This one is sort of like spread out into wherever they can find studio and do tracks and stuff like that.
They changed it for all their albums.
Yeah.
Every album was different in where they how they did it.
Yeah, so this one was very on the run. And I think what they were doing is that they're trying to capitalize off of how great One did in their popularity, and they're like, let's get this out. And so there was a real push that I think the schedule of it, like, almost killed the band. Like, I mean, they're touring and recording, and it's just it's a very sort of a heavy pace. The other thing that came up later for this album is this album had the most of the sort of appropriation crediting issues for the band. So there's a lot of different lawsuits came out of this album because there were blues artists that they didn't credit on the original pressing, where they took lyrics and songs and stuff like that. Where at the time they're like, oh, we're paying respect to these artists. So we're adding some stuff in that influenced us. And then later came back in the 80s to then want writing credits for those. So that'll come up when we talk about the songs, but that's sort of a major thing with this album. And a thing that sort of dogs other English bands at this time and Motown. Crediting is a big issue around this time.
Yeah.
About who wrote what and when, because they were getting covered so close together that it's a bit of an issue that they like have. It's been all dealt with now, but that's sort of a legacy of the band as well. Oh yeah. So the other thing is the crazy stories is since they were on the tour, they were like all these crazy like tour stories, and you got to read Hammer of the Gods. You have to read it, people, because it's just nuts. Like there were stories of. Like they had parties, and there was a story of they had the party in this hotel, and it was by water, so you could like fish off the like deck.
Oh yeah.
And they were pulling in fish, and there was like orgies and heroin, and it was just crazy.
Oh my goodness. Dude,
I was reading some of this in Rolling Stone. It's insane. I don't even know. Right. I don't even know. If I don't feel comfortable talking about it on the show, then I read some crazy things, man.
That's all I'll say. It's like one of the stories involves drugs, alcohol, an orgy, fish, and Bonham just sort of drinking in the corner for like 5 hours. That's one of the stories. And all that was going around the recording of the record. And a lot of it was behind their manager, Peter Grant. So he wanted to really capitalize off this record. And as a manager, like he was getting in fights with like people at concerts from like the Stones or something, and he has a history of like beating up other managers and trashing hotel rooms.
Oh yeah, he was violent.
So he was sort of like driving this really crazy pace that Plant and the engineer. And actually the pace was so crazy, I read this, that they actually turned down performing at Woodstock to finish recording the record.
Interesting.
So they turned that down because of the pace of the record was so high. And the engineer at the time is Eddie Kramer, who will engineer some other records, but it was a very sort of collaborative between him and Page. And I think when we talk about the guitar work, because Page was the producer, like his guitar is really heavily featured in this record. Like it's a very guitar driven in a lot of
I would agree on that
songs. Yeah.
I agree on that.
Some other interesting tidbits really quick. Is that the cover is based on a World War II photo where they just added in like the band's pictures. If people are wondering where that cover came from. It's like World War II pilots, I think. For me, this kind of cements Plant and Page as the Lennon and McCartney of Zeppelin, because the Zep 2 is where Plant first starts writing full songs, which he'll do in later albums. And you sort of have this kind of Lennon-McCartney sort of combination of Plant and Page that really, I think, drove a lot of the records. And it sort of starts here with Plant getting more of the writing responsibility. And so if you have an original pressing of this record, all the songs will say written by Plant and Page, Plant and Page, Plant and Page, Plant and Page. But if you have a pressing after 85, it'll have Willie Dixon, you know, how, you know, all these other credits. So that's how you can, a little pro tip if you want to tell if you have an original pressing or not.
Yeah.
Just check who's credited, and you can tell if it's an original pressing or not, or a pre-85 pressing anyway.
Yep.
This was their first album to make number one on the U.S. U.S. top. Do you know who it toppled at number one?
Oh, in 69? No.
Abbey Road.
Wow. Wow.
Knocked off Abbey Road.
Abbey Road was sort of the beginning of the end for the Beatles too, wasn't it? Wasn't it all, they all hated each other by that point?
I think
Abbey Road was technically their last album, even though Let It Be came out afterwards.
Let It Be was released after the group.
Yeah.
Divided.
After the group divided, but it was recorded, I think, before Abbey Road.
Well, Hey Jude 2 was released afterwards, wasn't it? Hey Jude was also released after the band broke up.
It was a late release.
That's about John's son.
Yep.
Going through the divorce.
Yep.
I think Abbey Road was when Harrison, McCartney, and Lennon all recorded their parts to songs in different studios.
Probably.
Interesting.
They would be in the same studio. But anyway, that's just a bit of like context around the record. And when you look at how great this record is, like I said, always keep in mind that they're also playing like stadium shows around the world at the same time they're recording it, which is pretty crazy.
You don't ever hear, that's like unheard of. Like even then, I think it was unheard of. You know, so that is
your thoughts, Will. You can hop in and say,
yeah, I actually moved some of my thoughts to the end, but I have one thought I want to make and add on to that. You know, this is a sophomore album for Led Zeppelin. And, you know, anytime Led Zeppelin 1 was a very well received album, it did very well. To have that second album, and I think we could make a fair assumption this second album eclipsed the first album. That's the kind of sign where you know Led Zeppelin's going to be a very special band down the road. And then we can get into some of the changes they made with some of the other albums. But that's kind of like my feeling on this is when you can put out a sophomore album and just nail it. You know, they could have easily had, you know, hey, we had this big hit album and, you know, just crash and burn. And we've seen so many bands that's happened to. It didn't happen with Zeppelin here, and they just got better. You know, there was, you know, more albums. 3, 4 would follow Physical Graffiti, so a lot of more albums down the line would happen. So I think that was a big important part of this, you know, their progression as a band here.
Absolutely.
All right, should we kick off the record?
Let's kick off the record. So I guess what I wanted to say, we're doing this by sides, side one and side two. And I know we talked about this when we did the Stones, Let It Bleed. There's still something when you produce an album of having sides, and I think this album is going to fall into that category when I give some of my commentary down the line.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's the first track, Whole Lot of Love.
Woo! Now, I went down a rabbit hole, listened to Straight Zeppelin for like 2.5 hours yesterday, and I just want to list off their opening tracks to like their first 5, 6 records.
Okay.
You got number one, Zeppelin 1, their opening track, Good Times, Bad Times, which is just like jump right into it.
Yeah.
Opening track to 2, Whole Lot of Love.
Oh, yeah.
Opening track to 3, Immigrant Song.
Oh.
Opening track to 4, Black Dog.
Yeah.
Opening track to Houses of the Holy, Song Remains the Same.
Oh,
oh yeah.
Opening track to Physical Graffiti, Custard Pie. Opening track to Presence, Achilles' Last Stand, and In Through the Outdoor, It's in the Evening.
You know, I forgot.
So their opening tracks.
I forgot that Achilles' Last Stand was the intro to Presence. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. What that says to me is they spend a lot of time figuring out how to kick off a record.
Yeah.
Because all of those opening tracks just like kickstart the record. Right? And a lot of those opening tracks are like iconic. And they just get it. A lot of them are kind of shorter, around the 2.5 minutes or so, 3 minutes. And they just jumpstart the whole record. And so it's just interesting when you're looking at record construction, like their opening tracks and how that fits in with the step 2 with Whole Lot of Love, which is just fire from, you know, you drop the needle and it's like bang.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's a powerful start. I mean, that's, you can't start an album much heavier than Whole Lot of Love.
No.
And it's probably one of their most popular songs. It's one of their
that opening guitar riff, yeah. It's, you know, this was the right song to be the opening track of the 9 songs. There's no question. They got it right with this track.
You know, it kind of, if you think about it, they're touring in the summer. It's 1969. It's crazy.
Yeah.
This song is perfect. I mean, oh, yeah. This is a perfect, not only is this a perfect summer 1969 song, this is a classic. You get in your car, you put the windows down, you blare the radio, a Whole Lot of Love is a perfect song for that. Yep. It's a summer drive song.
Yep.
Now, this is the first song, too, not only the first song of the album, but this is the first song where the appropriation and not crediting rears its ugly head. Yeah. Because what happens is, Page came up with the riff to build the song around, which is how a lot of Zeppelin songs were constructed. It's like, let's just throw a genius at guitar, and then we'll just make something around it, pretty much. And at the time, Plant was listening to a lot of Muddy Waters. And so when he started singing over it, he was getting really influenced by Muddy Waters, and he was dropping in like Muddy Waters verses from You Need Love by Muddy Waters. That just made it to the record. So later, they credited Willie Dixon with a writing credit because he was just sort of like, he was listening to it at the time and was just dropping in lines from that. And so they ended up crediting him in the end. But you'll see a lot of that then throughout this record.
You know, you guys mentioned the opening riff. Dave, you mentioned that opening riff. Iconic. I mean, it's just iconic. I think it's one of the great opening riffs out there. You mentioned where, you know, this song had a very classic late 60s kind of feel to it. I could picture you, me, Dave, Seth, and myself maybe in San Francisco in a park with our hippie headbands, like playing this song, right?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd be in a park, man.
Right.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah,
right. There was a psychedelic element to this song on top of it. Okay, it bridges blues to psychedelic very, very well. And I'll mention the psychedelic thing as a theme throughout the first side of the album. Couple key musical notes. I think Bonham's drumming 32 seconds in kind of comes out of that riff and brings you right into the song. And I think there's a couple of cool musical interludes, particularly at the 120 mark. And then there's a little more of a psychedelic kind of interlude at the 2-minute mark that really like I said, everyone remembers the riff, but those other parts musically round out this song very nicely.
Yeah, and then I'll let Seth jump in as soon as he's done getting a cigar going. But in concerts, this would usually be a medley song. So during that sort of psychedelic interlude, they would go into like an Elvis song or an old blues song, and then come back out.
Yeah.
So when you look at a concert, you'll be looking at it and you know the running time on the record and you're like, why does Whole Lot of Love go for 35 minutes? It's because
it's
they use that time to,
you know, they had that with like Dazed and Confused was another one, which they would go. And there's a couple bands in this group. Allman Brothers was another one that would do it. They'd find a song and they'd go into it. But yeah, this is definitely a song that would expand for a long period of time.
Yeah.
They'd roll with it and each person would play their part.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree with you on that. And there's another.
I don't think they'd open a concert to it. I don't know. I'd have to look at it, but I bet they didn't. I bet they never opened a concert to it. This was like halfway through the concert, we got to get some juices flowing again.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Good Times, Bad Times still is a quintessential opening song.
Yeah.
Concert. Yeah. I mean.
All right.
We're
going to song two.
Song two. What is and what should never be?
This is the first one that Plant writes the whole song. So this is his first sort of like, write it up, Robbie. Here you go.
Rub it up. Write it up, and he did.
And this is the first time where Jimmy Page starts to do some stuff with production. So I love the guitar work on this song, but I looked at sort of the production around it, and he started doing a lot of stereo stuff and phasing in and out of vocals, which, you know, is part of that sort of psychedelic sound and things like that. And actually, I was reading an interview, and Rick Rubin credits the production of this record and the production that Page did on this record as a major inspiration for him.
Interesting.
Around the stereo and the phasing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just great. Now I have a little rumor, since we were talking about rumors before. So the rumor in Hammer of the Gods is that Plant wrote this about an affair he had with his wife's sister.
I wouldn't be surprised, man.
Which gets very interesting about a song that's going to come later in the record.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so very guitar forward, just a good track.
When
what
do
you guys think?
It's a dark song, and it's really a lower step from Whole Lotta Love. It really, you know, Whole Lotta Love grabs you, and this one's like, let's settle back down.
Yeah.
We talk a lot with cigars about complexity, and we love our transitions in cigars. This song's like that equivalent of that type of cigar.
It's a transition song, you're right.
It's got transitions in it. It's a masterpiece of a recording. I still think there's an underlying psychedelica to this song. If you kind of look at it, it's kind of, again, more of a psychedelic song. Some of the key music pieces I'll point out, there's Bon. I always feel Bonham when he kicks it in. That's when the song really kind of goes into its groove, and there's a couple points, particularly at the 25-second mark and the 117 mark. If you listen to Bonham's drumming, it's right on fire with that. There's that Beach Boys influence in this song, where you hear the woo, you know, kind of almost like it's Beach Boys. And I'm wondering if they were influenced a little by what, you know, because the Beach Boys were in their creative, that was their creative peak at the time. Everyone was, you know, looking at Pet Sounds.
Yeah, it was like, what, a year or so after Pet Sounds?
Yeah. Roughly? Yeah. So it's not impossible to say that didn't, I mean, I don't think it was a copy of the Beach Boys, but I think it was an influence, certainly.
Yeah.
And it fit in with this song. And the key thing with this song is there's these pauses that happen. Like, it's pause, it's a momentary pause, and then it starts again.
Yeah.
And I think Led Zeppelin just executes it really, really good without breaking the complete momentum of the song. But they get this pause in there, and then it kind of restarts these transitions. And then finally, I think at that 3:30 mark, that's where Page just with the guitars come in there, and he just, you know, he's just kicking into high gear there towards at that 3:30 mark. So I look at this is one of my favorite tracks musically on this album.
It's a great one, and the finish to the song is it's a powerful finish, man. It's like, I've had enough. Done
it's
playing
an underrated games. Song too.
It is.
I got the guitar and the drum in my head now.
But you know,
he really snaps it. Like, it really,
that's
snaps.
What I'm saying. Yeah, there's points where Bonham has his moment in the song, and like I said, I agree with you. It's a Page-driven album, but Bonham has his moments in this song too, and that drum comes in, and it just, you know, the Bonzo's there.
It's a heavy cymbal album. I feel like.
Yeah, I'm gonna reference some cymbal points in a couple of other songs too. You're right.
And just my listening to this, and listen to it this past week. I mean, it's one of my, it's a really, you know, it's one of these, if you're looking to be like a powerful drummer, that's just going, I don't want to say going with the flow. You're still leading the band, but you're not really taking the spotlight for most of the album, except for one song.
Yeah.
But you are just keeping it going, keeping it steady while having a presence. It's a great album. Bonham's fantastic in that sense.
Yeah.
You can speak really intelligently about drummers, Seth. So can you just talk a bit through like Bonzo as a drummer? Because I think he does. I mean, Page gets a lot of the limelight here.
Oh, yeah. Tons of triplets. I mean, he was a single, you know, he played the bass with only one, you know, he didn't have a double pedal. He was a single pedal, but he was just a master of the triplets on the bass. And he knew how to work it really well with the snares and the hi-hat to really lead the group. And he wasn't that traditional drummer at the time of, you know, you think of, you know, Charlie and Watts and Ringo Starr and a lot of these groups, drummers of other big bands. In some ways, you know, early on, it's still, you know, Pink Floyd isn't there yet. But it's kind of like even Ginger Baker, there wasn't really anything complex drumming, but there was nothing really taking the forefront and really grabbing attention. And Bonham was that drummer that was like, dude, it's cool to be a drummer.
Yeah.
It's like, you're a badass if you're a drummer.
Yeah. I mean, what keeps it going in my head with this song is right after the chorus where he snaps in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then just that little interlude after the chorus to then lead into the next verse. It's just so well done.
Yeah. There's a lot of aspects of it. It's knowing that it was recorded live and thinking about how Led Zeppelin was as a band, and that Jimmy Page was he was into the showmanship, and that's not an insult. People loved seeing him. He was that, you know, guitarist with that mystique quality to it. You have to be able to understand your guitarist and keep playing and keep rolling. While not just fading away and keep the song rolling. And he was perfect at that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting hearing you say that. Whereas like, if you had maybe a drummer that was more in the background,
they would have been steamrolled. They would have been lost.
Yeah.
Page and John Paul Jones would have overpowered any other drummer. They were two good studio musicians and they were great on the stage. So they knew how to just keep rolling and be creative. So a drummer really had to think about it and keep going.
Let's go to the Lemon song.
Yeah, get in there.
This is a sexual song, man.
Yeah.
Oh, you reckon?
Supposedly this made women go nuts at concerts.
Yeah.
Supposedly women were absolutely crazy at concerts when this song was played. Because he made it even more, the sexual references were much more pronounced live. It was like,
yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, you don't.
Can you just imagine?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Can you just imagine Plant doing the song live? Like the shirt, if it's buttoned at all, it's only the bottom one. Like hair everywhere. Just like the tight flared pants, just like going for it. It would be incredible.
Have you guys have seen the movie Almost Famous, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Do you remember when the lead singer, Jason Lee, is saying, "I look for the one guy in the audience who isn't getting off and I make him get off"? Remember that line?
Yeah.
He says that line. Cameron Crowe, that was supposedly based off of Robert Plant's mentality of like, I'm looking to connect with every single person out there. And if I find one person who looks like I'm not into this, I'm going to make them into this. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get them to buy into this and love this. And I think he was able to not manipulate the audience, but he was able to entice them to be like, oh my man. God, he is a golden god. Like, jeez.
This is a song. I mean, what did you think of the song, Coop?
So, I mean, with some of the notes you had were very similar to mine. So, I mean, first of all, it's very bluesy, right? I could see, Dave, why you really like this song. It's a very bluesy type of track. It doesn't have as much of the psychedelic maybe as the first two tracks, but it's very bluesy. And then you use the words, the dirty guitar, right? Mm-hmm. The dirty guitar, which you made the point, Dave, of, and this is kind of where I was thinking with it too, it's the early heavy metal influences that you're starting to see come out here. Well, it wasn't a heavy metal song, I want to make that clear, but it had that dirty guitar, that distorted guitar that you kind of hear, you know, it became very prominent on heavy metal as the 70s went on. They used it very well very early on for a band that, you know, it just wasn't as common then.
This guitar is filthy.
Jimmy undresses you with his guitar play in this song.
Oh.
Yeah, now, that's a good way to put it.
Now, once again, appropriation comes up in this song.
Yeah.
So, this time, just to be, you know, accurate, this was a Howlin' Wolf song, or reminiscent of a Howlin' Wolf song, Killing Floor, which wasn't credited, which ended up being credited. But if you thought the appropriation ended there in one song, you were wrong. Because to give an example of how complex crediting was around this time, there's also Robert Johnson does like the whole, you know, squeeze my lemon in his song, Traveling Riverside Blues. It goes back to that song. But the reason they don't credit him is because there's contention whether he lifted that from someone else.
Yeah.
So it's so convoluted that like he doesn't get credited, even though you're like, wait a minute, I heard that in another song, because they can't credit him because they thought he lifted it from someone else.
Yeah.
Just, which just shows how complex it is.
Yeah.
They talk about all this lifting and so forth. And I was reading and watching some documentaries on Pink Floyd. And one of the reasons why like Roger Waters got so irritated with David Gilmour was Gilmour would play all these guitar licks all the time and do these solos. And Roger's like, we got to work with something. We got to work off of that. That's fantastic. And he's like, ah, we can't. It's not mine. And Roger's like, well, then stop playing it. And then he played something out. And he'd be like, yes, that's it. I love that. Where'd you get him with that? Well, that's someone else's as well. And it got to the point where, like, Roger supposedly was just so irritated. He couldn't handle it because David just was having so much fun playing other people's stuff that they just – and he's just like, no, that's not ours. We can't do anything with it. Like, which just, you know – and I'm sure that what happened with this was Jimmy was just rocking out, and they're like – they're doing this live on the road. They're like, yeah, man, let's roll with it.
And I think that's the thing, like – Zeppelin were more like, and Page especially, because he loved like the music of it. And you see interviews with him now, and he's in like his record room at his house that has like 8,000 records in it.
Yeah.
And he's just putting them on. And the coolest thing you could ever watch on YouTube is Jimmy Page playing air guitar to a record, which is great. So he's just playing everything. And so I think the thing was they were such fans of music that this never crossed their mind.
No.
And then the Peter Grants and stuff were just like, yeah, just keep putting stuff out. Keep getting us money. And they're like, okay. And that just never occurred to them until like decades later when it comes back. And they start like crediting everybody and doing all of that.
Do you know what's funny though? And this isn't a knock on any original artists, but would we have even heard these licks or pieces of music, guitar riffs, if Jimmy Page hadn't listened to them? And worked with them? And I'm not, you know, they've paid their price in the legal battles. I'm sure they still turned up in the positive. I'm not too worried about Jimmy Page or anything like that. but like, would we have even known? You know what I mean? Like the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony. Remember, like Rolling Stones went after them because that was something like that. I listened to Rolling Stones. I never even remember that song.
I didn't either. Yeah. When I came out. Yeah.
Even my mother was like, I don't even remember that.
No.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a great, great song. And I think like when you hear Paige talk about music, like Paige would love this podcast. Like if he has to listen to Prime Time Jukebox, he'd love it. Cause he just, to listen to him talk about music, it's just from such a creative space, and like, you know, it's just so great.
Yeah, I like I said, we're three tracks into this, and like I said, they're three solid, just deep tracks. You can make an argument for all of these, just right out of, you know. And I go back, Dave, and it says, I wonder if it's because of the way this album was recorded so uniquely that they were able to just kind of maybe they did one song or one or two songs at these sessions. That just kind of where they were able to just put everything into it.
It seemed like, from what I've read, a very organic process where like Page would have some sort of riff he was kicking around, and he'd be sitting down with Plant. He's like, just sing some stuff over this. And they're like, yeah, we can do something with that. And then they would kind of do a bit of it here, a bit of it there, put it together. It was a very sort of like on the fly kind of organic thing, as opposed to like, let's sit down and, you know, write a song. And
Genesis would record like that in their later years.
Yeah.
That's how early years, I don't think it was with Genesis, but later years of Genesis, that's exactly what they would do. They would just go in and with a bunch of these concepts and put it all together.
It's almost as if they have all this creativity and emotion building up throughout the tour, and then they use these studio sessions to record a song as like, we're getting it all out of our system.
Yeah.
And then they
I'm
proud of something, and then they go back on the road and they're doing all their stuff again, and then they get something else out, and then it's almost like they're decompressing in some ways. Which they're probably, you know, still getting the same amount of trouble in the studio as they were on the tours.
Right.
And we talked, I think, on one of the previous episodes. I think being in the studio and being on the road, they're two different things. I think being on the road is still, while it's tiring, I think there's still a looser feel when you're on stage performing, as opposed to being in the studio under the microscope, having a producer shouting at you or whatever. It's that ain't right, you know, whatever.
I think there's a reward. There's a benefit, you know. There's this feeling of, you know, you have all these fans out there who are absolutely loving every single thing you do. It's rewarding.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a rock god, how do you end a side of a record where you previously wrote a song about having an affair with your wife's sister, than to end the track or end it with a track of thanking your wife?
That's,
which is very interesting.
Wow. That's a bold strategy. I mean, that's
very bold.
That's a power move. It's a power move. But it's a great, but you know what? This, are we on the next song?
We're on Thank You,
Yeah, so we're talking about Thank You.
Can you talk about a great finale to a side?
My goodness.
It's amazing finale. And like I said, the context around it, it's said to be written about Plant's wife, Maureen, where he just wrote a song about having an affair with his sister. But a lot of this was Plant writing all the lyrics. And it's one of my favorite, like, Zeppelin deep cuts. It's such a fragile, well-arranged song. It's such a great song.
Absolutely.
And if you look at the opening and ending tracks of, like, Whole Lotta Love and Thank You, like, it's just an amazingly constructed side.
This song had a nice transition off Lemon Song, too. You just mentioned the point-counterpoint of this song, but there's a flow with it, you know, and there was a nice segue into this. The way it was put on the album.
It's a circle, man. It's like, you know, you go out, you have fun. You're paying the consequences. You come back home, you have a really good time. You're happy being home. And then it's like, then it's going back out on the road again. It's just.
Yeah.
It's always great to see the family, and it's always great to get away from the family. I think that's kind of where they're going with this.
Yeah.
The two what do they say? There's like two families. There's the family on the road, then there's a family when you get home.
Mm-hmm. Family at the office, you know, office wife you have or something like that.
Well, I wasn't going down that road. I was more saying, like, you know, when you're on the road, when you're in a band like Led Zeppelin or any band, on the road, you're with your family, which is like your roadies, your band members, and more than likely, and you're acting like a bunch of idiots, but it's your family. And when you all get in trouble, you all get in trouble, but you're always there together. And then when you go home, you separate from all those people, but everyone actually goes to their other family, and they go back to their other lives and doing their things around the house and so forth.
Yeah.
But music, the way you were talking about too, Coop, if you
musically, there's some highlights, and Bonham's drumming is great in this song as well, but I think John Paul Jones with the Hammond organ in this song is like the secret sauce to this song.
Yep.
You know, we haven't talked a lot about John Paul Jones on this record yet or this album yet, but this is really one where he shines. There's almost a Beatlesque type of psychedelic feel to this song at times, I feel.
Yeah.
So if earlier on, we said that if I said the Beach Boys had some influence, maybe the Beatles had a little influence on this. But again, you know, Zeppelin was marching to their own beat for sure. And then again, they used that pause, that momentary pause at the 3 minute mark at his song. Led Zeppelin pulls it up better than anybody here.
There's a lot of buildups, and it's, you know, what keeps it heavy is really, there's almost this battle between John Bonham and John Paul Jones in the song.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Bonham is, you know, going for the forceful alternative, and Paul Jones is more of this church at home quality.
Yeah. And I just love any time. I think pulling a Hammond organ off in a song is not easy at times. It's got to be, the song's got to be written, the music's got to be written very well for that song, and someone that gets to play that well. And I think in this song, to me, this was John Paul Jones's moment on this album.
Now we flip the record over to side two, which I think is sort of my, I call side two, the beginning of side two, like the Mad Max Fury Road side of the record.
Yeah.
Because the first two songs is probably the best 1-2 song combo on a record.
Maybe one, two, three on this. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you go hot, we're talking, you flip it over, you go Heartbreaker into Living Loving Maid. Heartbreaker is probably one of my favorite Zeppelin songs. And it's just like this song, if we talked about the Seeds of Metal before, it's all over this song.
You know what Heartbreaker is on the next track? You know, Thank You ends like you're back at home. Heartbreaker's like, you know, it's the next morning.
Yeah.
You know, your wife packed you your lunch to go to the office today. So you have lunch at work. Then you get in the car, just freaking throw that thing in the back. You're like, I'm going out to eat for lunch.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I'm just doing whatever the hell I want now. This is, I'm back on the road and having fun again right now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's this song, Nirvana's covered it before. Eddie Van Halen credits the solo is very influential to him around his finger tapping style on guitar. Really took a lot out of Page's solo. And it's just like, it's like a whole lot of love. Like, we're back to like, here we go. Like, it's like, let's jumpstart this side. And it's just, it's an amazing song. Amazing.
I, you know, like if I said side one had a little more of the psychedelic influence, side two, and I know we mentioned some of this heavy metal stuff, which no doubt about, you're 100% right, another metal pioneering track. But this, I think, was a little more of a jam band style side. Like a lot of what they did here influenced a lot of jams. If you've heard, there's an Earl's Court performance of this song where it's like 9 minutes long, and they do like a classic jam into this where they start the song and then they go into those long musical interludes a la Grateful Dead later on, a la Fish later on. Where again, you kind of see that this is like the foundation for that. Not that this was written with that in mind, but this song became a foundation in here. There's blues in this track too. Let's not forget there's a blues influence. The 2:15 mark is a nice, it transitions to a blues jam kind of piece in the middle of the song here. So, great. You know, there's a lot going on with, we mentioned metal, we mentioned jam, we mentioned blues. And again, this is Jimmy Page at his best.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
The transition from like blues to like rock is just fantastic.
Yeah, this is like I said, this is just musical genius on this this album is musical. It's just such a musical masterpiece. I look back and how this didn't win a Grammy is still perplexing to me to this day.
This should win the Nobel Prize. Forget the Grammy.
Man, listen, they were not loved on.
No.
Critics. They were hated. And well, everything, every direction they went, people were, couldn't stand them. And you know, the thing is, and Led Zeppelin pulled that whole, the media, I mean, gosh, I hate to say this, but it's like, they almost pulled like a 2016 Trump and say, you know what, the media hates us, but I know you love me, so you should listen to us. And people, the fans loved them. They didn't care what the critics said.
You know, we had Dave Garofalo on this past Tuesday show on Special Edition, and Dave was a DJ. And Dave talked about it when his days of a DJ, the key thing was that the how people would try to get him to play a record, right? Led Zeppelin, because they didn't produce singles, it took them out of a lot of the records, radio stations, like where the only people who were paying attention to them were the album-oriented rock stations, which there were some, there weren't a lot, and really the tours. So that was the way they were kind of, the tours were really the ones that drove the album sales, I think, in a lot of cases too here. But because they didn't have that radio outlet in this case. Because so many other companies, other bands are trying to get their music played by DJs that they got lost with this.
Well, it's interesting when you can compare that to the Beatles, who at a certain point just stopped touring. Like they were just putting out records. Yeah. It's almost like the different sides of the coin.
Yeah.
Yeah, Zeppelin never gave up either aspect.
No, they never did. I mean, I think there were a couple of singles released in the 80s off some of the lost stuff by then, but...
But yeah, I think they only had one single, I think, released, and I think it was Whole Lot of Love throughout their entire career. They didn't push singles.
No, they didn't. It was album, and this is, again, when you look at album-oriented rock, putting the album together as a concept, this is the case here.
Now, I nerded out on Led Zeppelin last night, and to give you an idea of like the level we're talking about, I think out of the 3 hours I listened to Zeppelin, I think 40% of it was me just listening to this song, Heartbreaker, leading to Living Loving Maid.
Yep.
And it just not even the whole songs, just like the end of Heartbreaker and the beginning of Living Loving Maid. Because Heartbreaker ends, Heartbreaker, bang. And then there's like 2 seconds of break, and then Plant comes back in with like no guitar, but just Plant screaming the first couple lines of Living Loving Maid, and you're back into it.
Yep.
Like that transition is just, it just is so high octane to cut that song dead, Heartbreaker, and then the next thing you heard is Plant like screeching something, and you're back into it again. It's a very sort of high octane beginning of a side.
Yeah.
And the production decision around taking, like having that song just end dead and then starting the next one cold, like as soon as possible, it's just really, it's an interesting production move, and it really adds to the energy of this side.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I agree with that. In fact, this song to me, I'm not knocking this song, it's a great song. To me, I got to hear this song right after Heartbreaker. Like, it's just, you don't play one without the other. It's kind of what I'm kind of getting at. Because it is such a good segue that they have going on here that I like to play in both songs together, as well as the next one, Ramble On, which I think also has that same feel. So that's kind of, again, I don't necessarily think the song stands out as well on its own, unless Heartbreaker is played before that. And you made a point, Dave, of this that I didn't notice. Paige hated this song, and they
Paige
never wanted to play
the song.
Did they play it in concert?
He would refuse to play it in concert. He did not like the song.
It's a great follow up to Heartbreaker.
I don't know.
Yeah,
you gotta love it.
Yeah,
because his guitar riff on it is so great.
I mentioned that too. The Paige riffs are just right. You're gonna know it's Paige is on the guitar. And Bonham, here's Bonham's work on the cymbals and hats here in this song.
Yep.
Listen to Bonham's work on the cymbals and hats. That's a real nice feature in there. So that's a part where that stood out to me in this song as well.
That's funny, man. I didn't know that Paige hated playing.
Yeah.
So perfect, though.
Yeah.
You have to appreciate it.
Yeah. But I bet a lot of fans of Heartbreaker maybe who aren't deep track people of Led Zeppelin wouldn't realize this song and how it connects in there unless they have the album.
But I think it shows Paige's sort of growing as a producer to make the decision to put it there and working with the engineer to like, we'll cut it here. We'll start like where it's placed is perfect in the record. Like you guys were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Now I think the next song, Ramble On, is another one that segues in here perfect. But it's a little different here. It kind of, there's a change of pace with this song.
This is another summer song, man. Led Zeppelin's a summer band, but this is a summer song, if you know what I mean. This is just another one of those, you got to let the music blare, man. You got to live it.
To me,
this is sort of. I was just gonna say, for me, like this is sort of like the quintessential baseline for this era of music. Like when someone says 70s rock baseline, I think of John Paul Jones' baseline on this song because it's so iconic to me, that the baseline on Ramble On.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah. Good,
man. Yep. Yep.
And much like other Zeppelin songs that will come later, this dips into more of their folk tradition, and they're unpacking Lord of the Rings for you. Because
it does.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And which just goes to show you where they were as a. I mean, you wouldn't think about it today, though. You know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't think. When you think about it today, like if you go to a high schooler, you'd be like, hey, do you think a kid who really likes Lord of the Rings is also a really big party and rock star? And they'd be like, no, he's a nerd who plays Dungeons and Dragons. Well, that's not what Robert Plant thinks, because Robert Plant. I mean, and that's just, it goes to show you how, listen, they're crazy. They like to have fun times, but they're poets and they appreciated good literature.
Yeah, and I think it's too, like, no matter how heavy Zeppelin gets, they're not that far removed from that English folk tradition that's also a big part of their music.
Yeah,
they never lost touch of that.
Yeah.
The few other comments I have on this, so I think this is the best lyrical song on the album, by the way. I think Ramble On's is great lyrically. I love the lyrics of this song. It's strongest lyrically. There's a ticking percussion sound that's coming from Bonham here. So you hear this ticking almost in there.
It's like agitated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, but kind of, like I said, if you took that ticking song out, it would take a lot of that ticking sound out. I think it would take away from the character of this song a lot. And in Bonham on the drums in general, he just is connecting with John Paul Jones on the bass beautifully. So there's a great rhythm going on here with this song. And this is another one where if you want to really see the vocal range that Robert Plant can deliver, he just delivers a great range of vocals in this song. This is just where his octaves just shine and how he can just perform it, you know, at such different levels with that. It's demonstrated in this, which is, I think, really an iconic track by Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. That's one of my favorites.
It is. It really is. Like I said, if I had to pick the weakest track on this album, it's tough. This is how good an album this is.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in some ways, I mean, I know it's kind of crazy, but the weakest track is possibly the next track.
I'm going to, for the next track, much like Page and Plant in concert, I'm going to get off the stage. It just lets Seth go into.
I know what he's going to talk about too. And this is such an important track here. Yeah,
I'm going to leave the stage with my bang, much like how Page Plant would. I'm just going to let the drummer just take over.
Can we get some final recognition for drummers? This is the first song, I think, to really ever recognize
the drummer. Yeah,
the drummer. And we're saying, hey, man, we're going to have most of the song be a drum solo. And you know, most people were probably like, what the heck are you talking about? Like this, you don't do this. But I just think it was.
It's Moby Dick, by the way, this song. Moby Dick.
This just goes to show it's a band on tour and they think about every single member. And I'd love to know more about it. I don't know the whole backstory of it, but I'd love to know where this came about and how this ended up on there. You know, did John Bonham really want it on there? Or I imagine he did.
I mean, I know just structurally it's sort of, they're working off of a 12 bar blues sort of structure. And I think some guitar riffs in here that Page uses, it comes about from other songs that they were toying around with before, that got re-released in some other recordings. I think Girl with the Long Black Wavy Hair off of the BBC recordings is the guitar riff in that. They took it and used it in here. And then this is the part of the concert where they would just leave the stage and Bonham would play for like a half an hour.
He'd do a half an hour. And the other thing about it was not only would he play for a half an hour, but I don't think there's been any other drummer. I mean, I did it one time we did like a talent show. We this was one of the songs we did, and I did exactly what he did. Was I'm going to put down my drumsticks and play my drum set with my hands. I mean, because that's what he did with this song. He put down.
It's got the conga type feel. It turns into with that.
Start playing it like, and it's like. I remember watching this. You know, the songs remain the same. The little DVD of them, and I'm like, wait a second, what? Like this is absolutely insane. But that's just how confident he was and how he felt about the drums and how talented he was. I mean, he had timpani on stage with him. He had a gong on stage with him, and it wasn't like that was his. I think Nick Mason with Pink Floyd had a gong. I think more smaller gongs have become a part of it. I know the Allman Brothers, they had a pair of timpani that one of the drummers would leave his set to go play timpani during some of the songs, but you don't see that. You don't see that anymore the way you used to. Barry, it's one of these things. It's fun. It's kind of jammy. I think this is that song for the drummers. It's like, hey, you can get your own track on an album too if you're good enough.
Yeah, so, Roger Taylor from Queen also was really good with the timpani live.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, he had the timpani as well.
Yeah, especially in the live, he was really good.
The thing about it, which is so bold as well and shows how confident they were, like this is an 8 minute or something, 5-8 minute instrumental on their sophomore album.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like people will buy whatever, this is our 10th album, people will buy whatever we make. This is a track on their sophomore album and they're like, yeah, let's just do an instrumental for, you know.
It's an instrumental and it's not one of the songs where people are like, When you say Moby Dick, any respectable drummer is going to be like John Bonham, great solo. Mm-hmm. And any member of any person who appreciates music and has been in a band or has played with a band or just loves rock would say like, God, what a great drummer to have in your band. Like that's what it was.
This was the song I felt that gave Bonham or really identified with him as Bonzo. I mean, that was just that name and this song fit. This is the drum solo you wanted to hear in concert. Okay, this is the like. There are a lot of crappy drum solos out there. I got to be honest with you. Not there's some really good ones. Don't get me wrong. We could probably do a whole show on great drum solos. Some of them, you know, just are more or less. Some of them, I think, are forced. Sometimes this is not forced. Yeah. And again, if you look at jam band influence down the road, with the Grateful Dead and Fish. This is another example of something that kind of opened the door to kind of doing those types of things with that. And like I said, ballsy move putting this on an album too, especially when we talk about the track that was knocked off the album in places, which was a very good track. So,
yeah.
So I'm going to ask you this, Seth. So in your opinion, like, would this be one of the most well-known drum solos of all time? Or like, where would this rank up there?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any other drum solo from any big group that would reach this level.
A lot of them are improvised. See, a lot of them are improvised completely. Yeah. This has some framework at least to it when it's a drum solo.
Yeah. I mean, he got creative each time, but there was a sense of where he was going with it. I mean, I know we talked about this too when we talked about Ginger Baker with Toad and Cream. You know, that was kind of another one of those first drum songs where they never took it to this level that John Bonham did.
Now, go ahead.
One question for Seth and you, maybe, because I don't know the answer to this. What was Bonzo's reputation before, like on the Led Zeppelin 1 album before this was cut? Was he already being considered as, hey, this is one of the legendary drummers that we're seeing develop? Or did this one kind of cement him at that point is what I'm kind of getting at.
I think this cemented him. I mean, before he was almost this, you know, Bonham was this, they found him. I mean, he was this diamond hidden.
Yeah.
Playing with Plant. And he was a heavy drummer. He wasn't one of those classic drummers at the time. And he probably didn't think highly of any of those other ones. He thought they're all kind of too afraid to do anything and go out there and they were too focused on so much rather than just kind of leading the charge. And because of that, he really established his presence. I think this really elevated him. I still think When the Levee Breaks probably is the song that really cemented it for him. But this is the one that really got him up there into being fully recognized. Which is funny that When the Levee Breaks is really like the song that everyone thinks of. A lot of people think of when they think of John Bonham, and it's a great song, but I don't think it's his.
I agree.
Not nearly his most talented thing. I think like Fools in the Rain is probably one of the most talented things he's done.
Oh, that's my feeling too. Fool in the Rain is, you know what I think of that song? Yeah, that's a great song.
The time signature on it is just incredible for a drummer.
And I think like what Seth was saying, I think, and it still dogs him today, like with casual fans maybe, is he's sort of known as someone that hits it hard and that, you know, his drumsticks were the size of like flagpoles. Like, I mean, he would have really huge and like hit it really hard. And I think that was sort of the view. And I think that view still exists with, like, casual Zeppelin fans. But yeah, I think this, like you guys were saying, like, these songs really brought him out, the more technical, artistic side of him, I guess.
John Huber, there's not a Moby Dick cigar.
Woo!
Let's get a Moby Dick cigar, John.
There isn't.
Oh, no, I was just going to – now, I just went off the studio record, so I don't have much about the songs that were off the record.
I have only one – I'll comment on one that was off the record that I'll mention. But, but I know we're just doing the studio, but I want to just comment on one at the end.
So I just said the Bring It On Home. Now, I just have to say this is a straight-up Sonny Boy Williamson song written by William Dixon. And they didn't credit him for it, and they did – eventually, but the funny thing, because it sort of came out around the same time, the funny thing is, like, they did this song. Willie Dixon's record company was like, hey, what's the go here? And they credited him, and Willie Dixon didn't even know his song was on the record until later.
Wow.
So they sorted it all out. But the one thing I said about this song is what sticks out for me is about a minute 40 in, because I listened to it again last night a couple of times. The guitar riff and why I say it's a Mad Max Fury Road is like Jimmy Page is that guy on the back of the car with all the like amps that has fire shooting out of his guitar.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you hit a minute 40, he's just like a flamethrower, like all over the studio with that, with that riff. It is so killer. It just like obliterates everything. It's like a meteor hitting the earth. Like, it is unbelievable.
There's almost this competition in the end to see who can have the bigger finale.
Oh, that guitar solo.
They're all like,
and then when Bonham hits the drums, oh my god,
it was the Spinal Tap. Everyone was trying to take it to 11.
Oh man.
You know, this was — there were like three acts to this song. There's a harmonica bluesy opening that Plant's playing the harmonica on that. The second part of that song, it gets into more of the jam feel, bluesy jam it moves into. And then that last part of the song is just all hands on deck, the quintessential Zeppelin rock sound. I mean, it was just, you take all three of those, and that's what this song brought. It was, in my opinion, it was the great finale to it. This was the perfect closing song to this album.
It was.
So I think they nailed — getting the last song is always, I think, sometimes it's even tougher than getting the first song. And they definitely, at the end of that album, because here's how I look at the last song on an album. The last song on the album's got to have me wanting for more with the follow-up album. And there's no question that this had me wanting for more. You know, I already knew about Led Zeppelin 3, but if I was listening to this for the first time, I'd be wanting to hear Led Zeppelin 3 to see where they take it from there.
Well, when you look at closing and opening tracks, because Page really flexes on that guitar riff.
Yeah.
And if you think like that's the end of two, and then you start three with Immigrant Song, which is, you know, it's just — I just love that riff. I can listen to just that riff for 3 hours. Forget the rest of the song. Just that riff.
Yeah. Which,
and it's — the other thing is the finale, it's a great finale, and what it makes you want to do is turn the vinyl over and play A Whole Lot of Love all over.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Because it's just the whole cycle, man.
Yeah, it's like let's forget it. I gotta listen to this album.
I gotta go back again. I gotta go back. I gotta go back to it.
Yep. Agree. I mentioned the unreleased tracks off this album. Now, you know, at the time they, you know, you were constrained about how much time you can put on an album unless you did a double album. Yeah. So I don't know if there was enough for a double album. So, but there were a few tracks that didn't make it. That eventually made it onto the, you know, the CDs that came out later on, the unreleased stuff. And the one that stood out to me was La La. It's a, if you haven't heard that song, very Sgt. Pepper-ish type of song in a lot of ways. It was a good song, a really good song. I don't know what the problem is with the 9 songs they picked, which one you would knock off, right? So it was very hard. Oh, yeah. You know, do I knock off Lemon Song? You know, it's like, yeah, and that's a great song. So I kind of understand why it didn't make the cut. But, you know, it found life later on as the music industry evolved is what I'll say. But, yeah, they had 9 songs. And like I said, which one do you take off is the question. I wouldn't have taken off Moby Dick. I mean, because his start, what that meant for Bonham in terms of his legacy was so important. You know, that would have been the easy one, like you said, to take off. You guys said to take off, but you can't take it off. So
you can't, because it plays a role between Ramble On and Bring It On Home.
Yeah, very good point too. Very good point too. It's kind of like that penultimate type of song in a lot of ways. Right, I agree. I agree with you now.
Now, before final thoughts, do you want to give a cigar update?
Yeah. Dave, why don't you start? Because I'm most curious.
It's amazing. This cigar is so good. I think what I like about it is it has all the notes I really like from Broadleaf, but it's not heavy. It's really good. I mean, much like this album, I could finish this and just light it up again. Like it's just a really, and it's the construction on it too. Like it's not running out of gas or anything. It's still really smooth. It's a great cigar.
You get the broadleaf, but there's more to it than just the broadleaf.
Yeah.
You get that Aganorsa. It doesn't hide the Aganorsa tobacco in that.
Yeah.
What about you, Seth? What are you working on?
I moved to a HVC Serie A, the Cananazo, which is just a solid blend. Good cigar.
Yeah,
not near the broadleaf level, but it's a good solid stick.
Yeah, Dave, I don't know if you've tried that one. Have you tried the Serie A?
I think this is my first one I've tried.
Of HVC?
Of HVC. I've heard a lot about them, but I just haven't gotten to it. Like, I've heard a lot about the brand, but I haven't gotten to it till now.
This is a brand I think you're really going to – I mean, I know it's one that Seth kind of turned me on to originally. I got it when the 500 years new sizes come out. I think that's a size we need to get you.
Yeah,
the 500 years is really good. The A is it was one of the that cigar was very well received last year at the trades. I haven't reviewed that one yet. I have to review that one.
What size is it, Seth? Like, what is it?
5 7/8 by 52.
Okay,
they have a Corona size too.
Yeah, they do have a little Corona size. I gotta send them some of those 500s. I gotta send you some of the HVC 500s.
Yeah,
is that size, Seth? Is that better than the Corona? You reckon, or what do you think?
I like it over the Corona. But
I think Dojo prefers the Corona. He's really high on this blend. I think the Dojo guys like the Perlis, which is the 5 5/8 by 46, the Corona Gorda.
Yeah,
I'm kind of with Seth. I think the Toro actually is better.
How about you, Cube? How's your Rocky going?
Oh, this, like I said, this is a solid cigar. This is San Andreas Maduro. So in the second half of this, you're going to get a little more of the pungency off the San Andreas. It's not too bad. It doesn't get too overpowering, but you get more spice on the back end of this second half, I should say, as opposed to some of the sweetness you get in the first half. But still very well balanced. And, you know, like I said, this is burning perfect right now.
So final thoughts on the record, on Zeppelin, on everything, on life.
Oh, man. I mean, listen, Led Zeppelin 2 is probably one of my favorite Zeppelin albums. You know, it's probably one of my favorite albums in general. it's one of these things. I don't think it gets, you know, classified as the greatest Led Zeppelin album of all times. But it's, I think it's probably top three with ease. But I think, you know, Whole Lot of Love is probably one of their best songs ever. It's just a great album. And it's, now's the time of year for this album. I'm a strong believer in that this is a summer album. This is not an album for February. This is a, you know,
summertime album, man.
June, July, August, you know, album.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan, as I've said multiple times. When I was like 11 years old, I subscribed to a Led Zeppelin fanzine that was produced on like a Xerox copier in San Francisco when I was living out in Wisconsin. Getting it sent in the mail. I was sending in cash in the mail to people that were on the classifieds in the album for like bootleg tapes. And I was talking to my wife about this the other day. Cause I was like, I was wondering what my parents thought when I was getting like Led Zeppelin fanzines in the mail and ordering like bootleg cassettes of like Texas Pop 69 and stuff.
That's awesome.
They used to come on the campus of Rutgers, the bootleg cassette people.
Oh, yeah.
All that stuff. Yeah. And I mean, I always remember they were on campus in the student center and they were selling this stuff.
Oh, I loved it. So I got, so my favorite Zeppelin concerts, for anyone out there looking for concerts, so Texas Pop 69 in Blueberry Hill is what I had.
Yep.
And they're incredible. And so I did that. I mean, I just, a lot of stuff we talked about with the appropriation and the vinyl and everything, but for me, Zeppelin II really starts to show like where the band's gonna go.
Yeah.
Like the first one is like, here's this great band, check them out, buy this record. But I think Page and Plant really started to set the trajectory of the band, like the seeds of the metal that's just going to amplify. And like I said in my notes, that Page's riffs on here are like napalm and will be felt throughout rock for decades. Like, these are the foundational riffs for a lot of guitarists that are going to pick up in like 80s, 90s. Are the riffs that sort of are coming out in this record.
This is their second album, and as a band, when they're recording this, they still weren't even a year old.
Right.
So I think there was definitely a push. You know, I think Jimmy Page and Peter Grant had this push that they recognized they had something truly special. And then if they didn't carpe diem, then it could have just faded away.
Well, look how much creative energy that band would have had to put this out so close to the first one and on tour.
Yeah.
To just put this out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, Dave, in terms of, I totally get why you love this album too. You know, knowing how I've kind of gotten to know your music taste over the years, no doubt about it. You guys hit the nail on the head. This was an important evolution album for the band. It was an important album in taking that next step there. They took advantage of the momentum they had, creativity there, and they got this album out there. I think it showed a different side of doing a bluesy type, an album based on the blues. So, I mean, they weren't the first band to start, you know, doing bluesy type. The Stones were doing it. There were other bands doing it for a while. So I totally get that. I love the concept of the album side, and I kind of said a little more psychedelic on the first half, a little more jam on the second half. So I like how the concepts of the sides were kept together. This may be the controversial comment I'll make about this album, and you guys are probably going to disagree with me.
Oof.
I think this was an album stronger musically than lyrically. I think it was good lyrics. Don't get me wrong, the lyrics were really good, but musically, that's where it had the edge here for me.
Absolutely.
That's where it put it over the top.
I'd agree with you.
In general, I found that as a theme running on a lot of the Led Zeppelin albums. Yeah, obviously, Stairway to Heaven, I think that's a lyric, more lyrically driven in a lot of ways, too. But even Into the Outdoor towards the end, I think was still kind of decent lyrics, good lyrics. I think very good lyrics, very good lyrics, unbelievable instrumentation. So, that's kind of how I assess Led Zeppelin too.
I'd agree with you. I think Led Zeppelin III probably had the more lyrically strong.
Yes. Aspects.
Three and four, yeah.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, the three probably had the strong lyrics, but it was probably, it was really an unpopular album, Led Zeppelin.
It's probably, yeah, it would be that and maybe Presence are the two least popular.
Yeah, yeah, the two least, know. Yeah.
Yeah, but not bad, really good albums is what I'm saying.
Yeah, they're still, I mean, gosh, how many other bands would kill for those albums?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And your worst album's better than anything I'll ever do. So.
Right, right. Yeah, 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 like, yeah. If some album has to rank at the bottom, you know, I'd probably still say Three's better than Presence, but that's just me.
I think Three's better than Presence. I think Achilles Last Stand's fantastic, but
Great song.
Itself is not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In Through the Outdoor, like I said, I think if you said 1980, it would have been the most disappointing album at that point, but time had a way of, I think, getting that album appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you go. That's our album. Let's say album Archaeology dig into this album there. For the Battle of the Band 2020 champions.
New music time, Coop.
Yep.
Mention
Scar Hustler. Visit Mike and Greg and the folks down in Deltona, Florida at Cigar Hustler. I believe the Espinosa guys were there last night doing cornhole. If you can't get down to the store, certainly check out their online store, as Dave has been doing, and telling you about the great customer service you're getting from Mike and the guys there as well. So visit www.cigarhustler.com and check out what they got.
Yeah, go to it.
Yep, absolutely.
So the new music today. Now, one of the things about music is that it's sort of social activist side. A lot of music at the time, you talk about social issues, and this time is no different. So the theme here is around the Black Lives Matter. A lot of music is coming out now around that. So I wanted to sort of feature that because that's what some new music is. So we had Beyonce come out with a record or a track, Black Parade, sort of around the protests and around the Juneteenth holiday. Anderson .Paak, who's a big hip-hop sort of jazz-influenced artist, also came out with a single, Lockdown, about that. So we talked about that a while ago, but lots of music coming out around that. So the theme today is sort of around the sort of protests and things, because some music is coming out about that now. So you got the Beyonce track, Black Parade, and Anderson .Paak on the side B of the 45 with Lockdown. Podcast to check out, Code Switch, which I mentioned before, which talks about race and other things. They have an actual episode all about music and protest. So if you're interested, like musically, you can check that out. It came out, I think that podcast came out a couple weeks ago, but you can check it out, Code Switch. The title of the podcast is called Songs Giving Us Life. It's about music coming out and that sort of thing. So it's a good music one to check out. Also, for people that were interested, I got some feedback on this. There is a playlist I made called the Respect Playlist, which is a lot
of people are asking about that playlist. Songs. Yes, a lot of people have been asking about that. Yeah, we'll include it again. Yeah,
we'll include it again. It's for people that are interested where sort of the issues that are going on. It's a lot of music around that because it's a good way to get some insight into what's happening. And people asked about sites to donate as well. I've been getting feedback on that, so you can check out either the Black Lives Matter site or the Bail Project site and donate there. So just sort of like, since people got back in the studio, you're seeing a lot of music come out now, much like civil rights in the 60s and stuff like that. So expect a lot more music to be coming out around the issues we're facing today. It'll be interesting to sort of see that. So there you go.
Yeah, I think, you know, Beyonce, obviously one of the major artists just doing that. I think you're going to see a big album from someone come out before this year's over. And that album, there's going to be something big, and it's going to be someone big in the music business will do it. And you watch. I think there's going to be a lot of creativity coming out of that. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we're going to get music-wise with that.
And with a lot of music coming out, I don't know about the Anderson .Paak. I don't know, but I know Beyonce's. I think the proceeds are going to a charity in Houston, which is her hometown.
Yeah.
So a lot of music. There's a lot of singles around that. Like with COVID, there were some singles around that. So this sort of falls within that tradition, I guess.
It's all the single ladies.
Yeah, all the same.
And then, do you have some thoughts on the Rivals podcast, Will?
Yeah, I have really been getting into the Rivals podcast. I went on a binge.
Listen to that, Seth.
I went on a binge with it. The guys who do this podcast they do a great job. All right. Like I said, they take two people in a band or two bands that are having a rivalry. I listened to the Elton Billy Joel one, which was really good. The Pink Floyd, the Roger Waters and David Gilmour. And the Pink Floyd one was really good because they go a little beyond that, talking about they talk a lot about Syd Barrett in that one too. Here you know, and these guys, like I said, they are just, I think it may have been their podcast where they mentioned how the music industry, when it comes to these charity type of things, they're able to put a lot of differences aside, and people get together when it comes to a common cause. And that seems to sometimes be the ultimate, you know, icebreaker in a lot of these cases. Some bands don't, you know, for whatever reason, but, you know, so you see it. But this Rivals podcast, if you're a music fan, just go on iTunes and, you know, you could just subscribe to Rivals. I think they put out new content almost every week.
Yeah, you got to check it out, Seth.
I do. I got to check it out. I'm going to have to check it out.
It's in my regular now listening mode with this. So I went on a binge to catch up on a lot of these. There's a couple of Beatle ones out there.
Yeah. They have a Pink Floyd one with Gilmore and Waters.
Nice. I would love to get these guys on the show. I would love to get these guys on the show at some point and talk to them.
I have tried. They do one on Billy Corgan that's sort of like Billy Corgan Rival versus the World.
Yeah. You know, Billy Corgan inducted he inducted Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Yeah, he inducted Pink Floyd into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, yeah.
Seth. I loved all the, like, drummer stuff, because I can't talk about that as in-depth and knowledgeable as you can.
No, man. Thanks, guys. Yeah. It's a great album to talk about.
No, that's good. That's really good, yeah. No, we appreciate it as well, Seth. Like I said, for folks, we'll have the album, of course, as part of the playlist here, where you can go listen to that and for your enjoyment there. Next show, assuming that Dave gets his cigars, is going to be the Women in Music show. Seth, we want you as many shows as you want to do, and we'll get you some scheduled stuff, too, on that.
Sounds good, man.
We have a bunch of topics, and we love having you as part of the show. I just want to say that. Man.
Thank you.
We thank you. I think. And thanks to our audience. The feedback's been enormous that we're getting. Dave, we said we were going to do 10 to 12 shows in a year. We've now done 13 in 8+ months.
Nice, guys.
So that's because we're getting the reception, and there's just been a lot of things we want to talk about music-wise and listen to music-wise. So we want to thank everyone as well on that. With that thought, that's going to wrap up Primetime Jukebox Episode 13 Into the Annals of History. Stay tuned to our schedule for the July shows. And like I said, I think the next one's going to be the Women in Music show. We have a ska show, I think, coming up as well, and more. So you're not going to want to miss out. And with that, take care, everybody, and be healthy and be safe.